On behalf of Michael Basler and myself, I should first of all like to thank Greta Olsen for this very, very kind and much too generous introduction. It has been such a pleasure and privilege to work with her, not only on this lecture series, but also on other projects. It's our pleasure today to introduce a topic that's called Literary Studies as a Form of Life Science, the Knowledge of Literature. When Michael Basler and I got together this morning, we realized that each of us was very, very eager not to let the other one down. That meant that we thought, okay, I have to pull my weight. I have to prepare something that's worth at least 90 minutes. We're both old football players. Das Spiel dauert 90 Minuten. So when we compared notes, we realized that basically what we had done is write two very long manuscripts and to prepare something that could easily last us 180 minutes, probably even the whole semester. So the real problem today for us will be to shorten this in such a way that you can follow what we have prepared. We've put in lots of energy, and we'd be very, very delighted if you would get as much out of it as possible. The topic is called Literary Studies as a Form of Life Science, the Knowledge of Literature. You may well ask yourself, so what's the approach? One might as well begin with the observation that in contrast to some of the previous lectures in this series, the lecture today will not so much be concerned with delineating one particular theoretical approach or one method, but rather an ongoing debate about a number of very important research questions, no matter whether you do anglistic, Germanistic, Romanistic, or vergleichende Literaturwissenschaft. While other lectures presented what can be called fully-fledged approaches in literary and cultural studies, for instance, the new historicism or gender studies, we will try to outline the debates surrounding the relationship between literature on the one hand and knowledge on the other, and we'll make a modest attempt to intervene in this debate. So what are the research questions that we are concerned with? You see them on the slide. All of these are key questions of literary studies. Let me take you through them. We realize that we've prepared 30 slides, so I shouldn't go on for longer than 3 minutes on any slide. First of all, how can the relation between literature and knowledge, or more broadly speaking, between literary text and cultural context, be conceptualized? This is a key question that lots of people have pondered. Second question, what are the key concepts needed for the reconceptualization of what has been called the knowledge of literature? What does literature know? Number three, what are the main functions that literature serves to fulfill in any society? Number four, what kind of knowledge does literature represent, but arguably also disseminate or even generate? Number five, how can literary and cultural studies be developed into a form of what we've called life science, that is, into an academic discipline that is concerned with knowledge about life? Number six, what are the theoretical approaches that such a project can profitably draw on? And from question number six, you can immediately see that this is not one particular approach, but a series of questions that you will all have to grapple with. So the question is, what other approaches can we draw on if we want to consider the knowledge of literature? Number seven, what are the methodological consequences for such a new approach to the functions and knowledge of literature? In other words, how can you actually do literary studies as a form of life science? And this is, of course, the question which is most important for you, not all the concepts involved in a theoretical approach, but what can you actually do with it once you read a short story, a play, or a novel? And last but not least, what do we all stand to gain by pursuing such a project in the first place? These would be the questions that we'll try to answer. So what are the goals of this lecture today? First of all, Michael Basler and I will try to provide you with a preliminary map of theoretical approaches in literary studies. This map is supposed to serve two functions. First of all, we hope that it will enable you to place the lectures that you've heard so far on this broader map of approaches in literary studies. And second, this map will hopefully give you an idea of which approaches you can fruitfully incorporate into the project of literary studies as life science. The second goal is a little bit more ambitious. We'll try to introduce some key concepts, theoretical approaches, and methods needed for the conceptualization of the knowledge of literature. Number three, we would also like to discuss the functions that literature serves to fulfill. Again, a question that all of you will have to address in any kind of BA or MA thesis, or even a written paper that you write for any seminar. Number four, we would like to present some concrete suggestions for how literary and cultural studies could arguably be developed into a form of life science, that is, into something that academics take seriously. And last but certainly not least, we would like to turn theory into practice, this is the motto of the whole lecture series, and provide literary flesh to the somewhat dry theoretical skeleton by looking at the short story as a repository of life knowledge. In short, as you can see, we will try to answer as many of the research questions outlined on the previous slide as possible. As you may or may not have realized, we have been inspired by Samuel Beckett. Samuel Beckett has once coined a wonderful motto. He said, "Fail. Fail again, but fail better." We will therefore do our very best to at least fail better in the attempt at answering all of these complex questions, which would keep a whole group of academics busy for weeks, months, or years to come. In doing so, we'll attempt to bring some conceptual and terminological clarity to the interdisciplinary debate on an investigation of what's been called the knowledge of literature. How are we going to pursue this very ambitious project? Before I give you an outline, or is the outline next? The outline is next, you see. This is the outline. You've also got it on the handout. I'll not take you through it because that would take up too much time. These are the five steps. It's just like a five-act play. Whether it'll be a tragedy or a comedy, we'll see, and perhaps you decide at the end. If you ask yourself, why would you do such a project in the first place, let us look at one quotation that sheds some light on it. Terry Eagleton once observed, quote, "Post-structuralism and then postmodernism dismissed all attempts to reflect on human life as a whole, as disreputably humanist, or indeed as the kind of totalizing theory which led straight to the death camps of the totalitarian state. There was no such thing as humanity or human life to be contemplated. There were simply differences, specific cultures, local situations," unquote. We think that it's important to address human life, to address human issues that all of you will be interested in. We hope so, at least, because otherwise you wouldn't have taken up anglistic. In a much more lighter vein, this is supposed to be a contribution to breakfast theory. This is what you find, or will find sooner or later, on some of the cereals. Postmodern Toasties, more than just a cereal, it's a commentary on the nature of cerealness, and so on. The mice, of course, wonder whether such breakfast cereals aren't pretty dry and flavorless, isn't it? Your question is informed, or should I say misinformed, by the conventionalized bourgeois cereal paradigms that center on such outmoded, escalatory notions as state, nutrition, and edibility. Finally, a breakfast commodity so complex that you need a theoretical apparatus to digest it. You want to eat it, you'll want to read it. A literary tour de force, breakfast as text. This would be lunch as text, and we'll try to be a little bit more serious by looking at literary studies as a form of life science. Where would you place such a project on a broader map? Let's look at the next model, which will shed some light on that. On this model, you see a communicational structure, all the instances that are involved in literary communication. And we would like to argue that it's important to take into account all of these various instances. When we talk about literature as knowledge or the knowledge of literature, we first of all, of course, talk about the text. What is the knowledge that a text projects? In doing so, however, we also have to take into account the authors as the people who produced the texts, and the author's knowledge, because the author's knowledge goes into the literary text in some way or other. We also have to take into consideration the reader, the recipient, because whenever you read a text, you inevitably draw on your own world knowledge. I'll not go into the others, the instances of literary mediation or criticism, but the context is, of course, of very central importance. So what are the approaches that such a project can draw on? This would be a map of theoretical approaches in literary studies. You don't have to copy this, because you'll find it, for instance, in the Introduction to the Study of English and American Literature used by Nadine Stritzke in her Grundkurs. This is just an overview of the kind of approaches that you won't have to be familiar with, but that you can draw on if you want to pursue literary and cultural studies as life science, if you're interested in the knowledge of literature. And I've taken up 8.52 minutes so far, because this clock tells me in no uncertain terms. And I've promised to Michael Busler not to outstay my welcome, not to go on for longer than 45 minutes. And the best thing is not to look at the manuscript at all. This always helps. I shouldn't write manuscripts at all, because they always detract from my attention. And when you really read a paper, it usually takes too long and it's much too boring. So the question we are dealing with today is basically concerned, first of all, with text. So we have to draw on text-oriented approaches. It also, of course, has to do with the historical context, that is, with the cultural knowledge that you'll find in any given society. Therefore, other approaches that you see on the top will also come in handy, particularly the new historicism, which you've also had a wonderful lecture on, presented by Ute Berns. Other approaches concerned with the author and the reader are not entirely unimportant, but these are not the key approaches that you would draw on if you pursue the project that we're trying to get you interested in today. Gender studies, for instance, presented by Nadine Stritzke 2 weeks ago, would also be very important, because whenever we read text, we draw on our knowledge of what constitutes masculinity, femininity, or our knowledges of what is queer. Postcolonial criticism and other approaches dealing with other contexts and other texts could also be incorporated into the project that we're trying to outline today. As I've said before, this is not a ready-made approach where you have the toolkit that you can simply apply to literary texts. What it is, it's an ongoing debate. Let me just take you through some of the stages of this debate, and I might even find them on my manuscript. First of all, the debate was started by a romance scholar, called Ottmar Etter. He presented an essay which was very, very influential, called Literaturwissenschaft als Lebenswissenschaft, published in the journal L'Endemont in 2007. As you may or may not know, 2007 was the year of the humanities. So humanist scholars had to come up with ideas that would show the public at large why what they were doing was important for society. Ottmar Etter argued in this essay that Literaturwissenschaft could profitably be conceived of as a kind of life science. He called it eine Programmschrift im Jahr der Geisteswissenschaften. So this is not the usual kind of scholarly article. It's a whole program, and lots of people responded to it. There was a big conference in Berlin, and there were lots of rejoinders to this essay, all published in the same journal, L'Endemont. If you think that this is something, again, peculiar to German academe, you'd be wrong. This is an international debate that is also conducted, for instance, in Italy. Angela Locatelli at the University of Bergamo has organized a whole series of conferences, 9 by now, there'll be the anniversary conference next year, all concerned with la conoscenza della letteratura. I love Italian, unfortunately I don't speak it. I know one sentence. The sentence goes, il mio ambito di ricerca è letteratura inglese dell'Ottocento. At conferences, people usually ask you, what are you working on? What is your specialty? And I always say, il mio ambito di ricerca è letteratura inglese dell'Ottocento, which I hope means my research area is 19th century English literature. I'm not sure, but I always say this. It's not the sort of thing that you should say at a party unless you really want to turn someone off. So a whole series concerned with la conoscenza della letteratura, the knowledge of literature. Another very international field that has emerged over the last couple of years is called literature and science. This is why I picked up volume number 8. This is big stuff in the US, for instance. People concerned with the interfaces between literature and literary studies on the one hand and science on the other. Another big project inaugurated by two Italians called Claudio Franceschi and Vita Fortunati. Only Italians have such wonderful names. Just imagine you were called Vita Fortunati. You could not but lead a very happy life, could you? Claudio Franceschi is one of the world's leading scientists, and Vita Fortunati has a chair of English literature at the University of Bologna. And the two of them really encapsulate the whole knowledge of literature and science. And they started a big project in which 80 universities all over Europe are involved in, called Interfacing the Sciences, the Humanities and Literature. This would be another big international issue in the same field. If you want to read up on this whole field, I think the best place to go would probably be Ralf Klausnitzer's book. Michael Busler and I are not in perfect agreement whether it's a first-rate book, a second-rate book, or just a book. It's called Literatur und Wissen, Zugänge, Modelle und Analysen, published by de Gruyter last year. And an upcoming publication would be Wolfgang Assholz and, again, Ottmar Etters, forthcoming volume, Literaturwissenschaft als Lebenswissenschaft, Programm, Projekte, Perspektiven. And these three words in the subtitle tell you what this debate is. It's a program. It's a program. There are lots of projects in this field, and it has, we sincerely believe this, otherwise we wouldn't be giving a lecture on this topic and wouldn't be working in this field. It has lots of perspectives, and we're trying to outline some of them. But it's not a single theoretical approach. How can you conceive of the whole field that we're trying to outline today? Our suggestion would be to draw on a couple of approaches and key concepts that literary studies has developed over the last couple of years. One of these would be a model developed by Paul Ricoeur. This, I think, is a very, very fruitful model that all of you should take into consideration if you want to do serious work in literary and cultural studies. I'll go back just for a second. Does this work? It does work. How has the relationship between literature and the real world traditionally been conceptualized? This is what you probably learn at school. Literature mirrors the real world. Literature is a representation of the real world. Literature copies the real world. All of these metaphors have several shortcomings. One of them is that they give you the impression that all literature ever does is just provide a one-to-one representation of the real. This dynamic model says that what we are concerned with is not just mimesis in the simple sense, but a dynamic process that can be split up into three stages. First of all, you have mimesis one, which you see at the top. This refers to the prefiguration of literature through real-world knowledge. So if we are concerned with the relationship between knowledge on the one hand and literature on the other, we should first of all start with real-world knowledge. All of you have acquired lots of knowledge already, and every single day at the university you acquire more knowledge. This would be the real-world knowledge. Prefiguration means that literature never starts from scratch. It always draws on cultural models, cultural schemata, on something that is already existent in the real, that already exists in the real world. At the next stage, we get to mimesis two. This would be configuration. Configuration means what does literature then do with this material that it takes from cultural context. What literature does is it configures real-world knowledge in particular ways. It uses plots, it uses metaphors, it uses point of view. This is what Paul Ricoeur refers to as configuration, and we put in parenth, of knowledge in literature. This knowledge that literature configures and produces then, of course, has an impact on the real world. And this is when we get to mimesis stage number 3. This is what Paul Ricoeur calls refiguration of real-world knowledge through literature. What this basically means is that literature has an impact on the real world. Literature is not just an imaginary alternative world. Literature can also influence the real world. This may give you some idea of how Michael Busler and I conceive of the relationship between the real world and literature, or to be more precise, knowledge and literature. If you think of it as a dynamic, ongoing process, you've got the main idea. In doing this, we are taking up ideas developed by other literary scholars, by other authors, by the people you've seen on the previous slide, but also, for instance, by very famous novelists. The next quote that you've got is by George Eliot. It's taken from George Eliot's letters. George Eliot, as you may or may not know, was probably the most famous Victorian novelist, at least the most famous female novelist. George was a she. She was called Mary Ann Evans. That's her real name, but she wrote under a pseudonym, calling herself George Eliot. Not to be confused with Charles Dickens, sorry. I was just going to rechristen him George Dickens. He was called Charles. In a letter, she described her novels as, "But my writing is simply a set of experiments in life, an endeavor to see what our thought and emotion may be capable of, what stores of motive, actual or hinted at, as possible, give promise of a better after which we may strive. What gains from past revelations and discipline we must strive to keep hold of as something more sure than shifting theory. I become more and more timid, with less daring to adopt any formula which does not get itself clothed for me in some human figure and individual experience, and perhaps that is a sign that if I help others to see at all, it must be through that medium of art." Here you've got a couple of key words. Please underline them on the handout. First of all, experiments in life. We would like to suggest that it makes a whole lot of sense to conceive of literature as a set of experiments, as a set of experiments in life. Again, this is where life and literature meet. George Eliot suggests that this is the cognitive potential of literature, that literature produces an experiment with, and you've got that on the, in the quotation as well, with some human figure and with individual experiments. So instead of teaching people something in a very explicit didactic way, she conducted her own experiments in life in what she called, last line, that medium of art. The next quotation is also from George Eliot, and it reads, "The inspiring principle which alone gives me courage to write is that of so presenting our human life as to help my readers in getting a clearer conception and a more active admiration of those vital elements which bind man together and give a higher worthiness to their existence, and also to help them in gradually dissociating these elements from the more transient forms on which an outworn teaching tends to make them dependent." Again, you have the word teaching. She was very violently opposed to didactic teaching. What she tried to do is to produce these experiments in life to present human life in artistic form. I've already got through that. We're really making progress. This is great. And I will continue not to look at the manuscript, which helps, because otherwise I'll be going on for much too long and that would curtail Michael's time, and his part will be much more interesting because he'll put a flesh to the skeleton. Nonetheless, you'll ask yourself, what will you actually do once you start reading a novel, a short story, a play? We would like to suggest that what you should do is to look at form, to look at, say, plot, to look at point of view, and not just at the content. And the concept that we would like to introduce is called the ideology of form. There it is. I never know because I've got two slides here. This is an elegant Apple computer because Michael is part of the Apple community. And I've now figured out that on the left is the slide that you see and on the right is the next slide, which in this case is called Vita. Oh, aktuelle Folie Vita refers to the next slide. I've now got it figured out. I'll not be confused. In an exam, one of the exam candidates once asked a linguistic colleague of mine, that was at the University of Cologne, not here, a colleague always says, whatever answer you give to his exam questions, meaning what? Meaning what? Which is, of course, not very encouraging if you want to take an exam. And after about 10 meaning whats, the candidate said, sir, am I confusing you? And my colleague said, no, I've been confused for years, which I thought was a very witty thing to say. But I kicked him under the table and said, just be nice to the people, because this exam is very important for them. It may not be important for you. What does the ideology of form mean? What does it mean if we talk about form as an interface between knowledge and literature, and as a source of information about ideology, knowledge, and worldviews? What it means is that it stresses that form is not something neutral. It's not something transparent. Point of view, a plot, is not a neutral representation of the real world. It actually forms life in a particular way. By stressing this concept, we would like to emphasize that literature should be conceived of as a cognitive force in its own right. And this is the quotation from John Bender, who, in fact, is often considered to be a new historicist, although I think he's a cultural historian. Quote, I consider literature and the visual arts as advanced forms of knowledge, as cognitive instruments that anticipate and contribute to institutional formation. Novels, as I describe them, and as Michael and I describe them, are primary historical and ideological documents. They are the vehicles, not the reflections of social change. Again, please underline the cognitive instruments. Novels should be considered as cognitive instruments. Cognitive instruments means as texts that actually generate knowledge, that produce knowledge, that do not merely imitate or copy or represent real-world knowledge. They do so because they use narrative forms, dramatic forms, lyrical forms. They actually form life in a particular way. What does this notion of ideology of form mean? Where does it come from? It comes from a Marxist critic called Frederick Jameson, and this would be the next quotation on the slide, and you've also got it on the handout. It's a long quotation, but please listen to it very... quotation, please underline they are the vehicles, not the reflections of social change. Because this emphasizes that it's not a mimetic view of literature, not of literature as merely copying something real. Novels actually change what is considered to be real. But let me now go on to the next quotation. This explains what ideology of form means. Quote, what must now be stressed is that at this level, form is apprehended as content. In plain English, this means form is actually something that has meaning. Form never only transports or conveys meaning. Form is meaning in its own right. To continue with the quote, the study of the ideology of form is no doubt grounded on a technical and formalistic analysis in the narrowest sense. Again, we would like to suggest to you it makes sense to do technical and formalistic analysis of, for instance, point of view. To continue with the quote, even though unlike much traditional formal analysis, it seeks to reveal the active presence within the text of a number of discontinuous and heterogeneous formal processes. But at the level of analysis in question here, a dialectical reversal has taken place, in which it has become possible to grasp such formal processes as, again underline this please, as sedimented content in their own right. As Michael will show you in his part, genres, for instance, or narrative techniques are really sedimented content in their own right. They are part of the tradition that novelists, dramatists, poets draw on. That is, sedimented content in their own right means that these forms carry ideological messages of their own, distinct from the ostensible or manifest content of the works. I hope you get the key idea. The two key ideas would be that literature could and should profitably be conceptualized as an active cognitive instrument, as something that produces knowledge in a very particular kind of way. I'll say more about the particular kind of way in a minute. And the second key idea would be that form is sedimented content in its own right, that form is always something that carries meaning. I've repeatedly emphasized that literature should be conceptualized as a cognitive force in its own right. And you may ask yourself, what are the functions that literature fulfills then? And this is an overview of some of the functions. I'll take you through them, but I think it would really make sense to copy this list, because with this list you'll be in a much better position to answer the question that your father, mother, grandfather, children perhaps, will ask you, why are you doing English studies and why have you specialized in literature? And you will say, because literature is one of the important ways of world-making. Doesn't this sound cool? Literature is a way of world. What does it mean? Any novel, any play is a world of itself. It's an alternative to the real world. It may stand in a variety of different relationships to the real world, but it is a real world. Any novel makes a world, and it may challenge the real world. Literature can also be conceptualized as, we've already taken you through that, as experiments in life, in the sense of George Eliot, and a contemporary philosopher, Catherine Elgin, talks about thought experiments, which means basically the same thing, but it's a very profitable way of looking at literature. Literature as a thought experiment. Hubert Zapf, an Americanist scholar from Augsburg, has come up with a tripartite model of functions of literature, which you should also write down. Literature can be considered as a cultural critical meta-discourse. Again, in plain English, this means literature can comment on cultural discourses, can do so from a meta-perspective. Literature is always also an imaginative counter-discourse. This would refer back to the way of world-making. That is, literature produces imaginative alternatives to the real world, and in doing so, it generates counter-discourses. Politicians like to tell us that there is no alternative to their particular policy, and whenever a politician says this, you should be very skeptical. There are always alternatives. And literature teaches us that we always have alternatives. Robert Musil, in Der Mann ohne Eigenschaften, talks about Möglichkeitssinn. Literatur aktiviert den Möglichkeitssinn. Politicians only have a Wirklichkeitssinn. And this is why it makes so much sense to spend your time with literature. Literary studies encourages people to become Möglichkeitsmenschen, and not just Wirklichkeitsmenschen. This is also due to their capacity, due to literature's capacity, as a reintegrative interdiscourse. Again, a very fanciful neologism. What does it mean? It means that literature tends to reintegrate the various discourses that in the modern society that we happen to live in tend to be differentiated in various specific subsystems. Law has developed its own discourse, the world of economy has developed its own discourse, and literature reintegrates these specialized discourses in a new way. So literature is the only place where you find all of these discourses taken together in a single text. In addition to these functions, literature can also function as a medium of collective memory. The topic that we were concerned with over the last 2 years is literature's role as a medium of representing, disseminating, and generating norms and values. This is the volume that Greta kindly mentioned in the introduction. So literature plays a very important role, not just at representing the values that you find in society, but also at disseminating and generating other values. And last but certainly not least, and this is the topic for our lecture, literature is an important medium of representing, disseminating, and generating knowledge. These are the functions of literature that we would like to stress when we talk about literature's knowledge, the knowledge of literature, or literature as a cognitive instrument. Let me now briefly take you through the project of what does it mean to do literary studies as a form of life science. What would be the theoretical and methodological framework? As I said earlier on, you would be wise to draw on a number of approaches, some of which you have already had an introduction to in this lecture series. Don't forget philology. It sounds like an old-fashioned term, but it does generate indispensable knowledge. Philology means love of words. Dienerin des Wortes, Liebhaber des Wortes. So by looking at words, this is where everything starts. And if you don't understand the words that a text is composed of, you're unlikely to make much headway in deciphering the knowledge of literature. Also, don't forget the virtues of close reading, championed by the New Criticism. The New Historicism sounds as though New Criticism was old-fashioned. The same, of course, applies to Old Historicism, but we would like to encourage you to always start with a close reading of texts and also with the virtues of wide reading, for instance, developed by the history of ideas and other old historicist approaches. Historical semantics, that is, looking at what words meant in a particular period, is also very important once you're dealing with texts, say, from the Renaissance, from the 18th century, or from any earlier period. Discourse analysis would be another approach that you could profitably draw on. You've already had a long introduction to the New Historicism and Poetics of Culture, so I don't have to go into that. In German, if you do Germanistik, people will talk about Poetologien des Wissens, meaning partly the same and partly something different. The great hero is Josef Vogel. Actually, it's Josef. Is it Josef with PH? I never know. I think it's with F. Then literary anthropology, analytical theory and aesthetics, cultural narratology, cognitive metaphor theory, literary pragmatism. If you think, I don't know what any of these words mean, we'll tell you where to look it up at the end of the lecture. Last but not least, I've also almost finished my part. Some hypotheses on the task and perspectives of a life science-oriented literary studies. What do we have to do before such a project is really feasible? First of all, what needs to be done is we have to come up with an explication or a definition of the key terms. What do we actually mean when we talk about life? What do we mean when we talk about life knowledge? What do we mean when we talk about literary life knowledge? These are terms that are bandied about. Nobody has really paused or bothered to define them. So this is something that is on the agenda. It hasn't been solved. I would provide you with definitions if there were definitions that could really be presented. There aren't. A second task that we have to consider is the consideration of the characteristics of literature as a particular kind of symbolic system. I've repeatedly drawn your attention to such things as point of view, plot, metaphors, rhetorical tropes. You should never forget that literature is a particular kind of symbolic system and that it has a number of characteristics that Nadine Stritzke will have introduced you to in the Grundkurs by now. So don't forget these. Don't only talk about content. Talk about narrative, dramatic, and lyric form, and pay very close attention to the analysis of these formal techniques. Another thing to be considered is the understanding of literature as autonomous, as a productive medium for generating life knowledge, and also meta-knowledge about the limits of knowledge. This is basically just a reminder of something that I've presented you with on the last two slides. Never forget that literature is autonomous, that it's a productive medium that can actually generate, in other words, construct a particular kind of knowledge. Don't only look for the ways in which literature mirrors knowledge that you find in society. Look at the productive functions, at the functions that I showed you on the last slide. The fourth thing to be considered is no less important. Please look at the existing approaches in literary and cultural studies when you're interested in the project that we are outlining today. Don't follow those who say this is a paradigm shift, this is completely new, something the world has never seen. Look at the approaches that I showed you on the previous slide and try to incorporate them in a very eclectic way when you do a BA or an MA thesis. If you want to talk about, say, the knowledge of literature about illness, fascinating topic, then please draw on the approaches that you saw on the previous slide. In addition, number five, we would also like to suggest that we do have to develop new theories, particularly new methods, and also perhaps new concepts for interdisciplinary collaboration between literary and cultural studies on the one hand and life sciences on the other. If we want people in the life sciences to take us seriously, we have to come up with hardcore theories, with methods that really deserve that name. Method is the way to reach a particular goal. So we have to develop these new theories and methods in order to be able to really forge interdisciplinary links between the humanities and the life sciences. Michael and I would like to suggest that it makes sense to practice life science-oriented literary studies that instead of literary studies as life science. So always remember that you're first of all dealing with literature, that your competencies are or reside in the analysis and interpretation of literary texts. Not a new paradigm shift. Start with literature, look at literature very closely, and try to figure out what it tells you about life and particular topics that we'll show you on the last slide. I'll skip the number seven because it's too complex. I think by pursuing this project that we've tried to outline, we will be able to come up with a correction and also an enlargement of life knowledge provided by the sciences. Don't only rely on the sciences. They're indispensable, they're very important, but you guys and girls are just as important. And I think this is one of the main reasons why it makes such sense to look at literature as a particular kind of life science and to look at the knowledge of literature, because literature can tell us so many important things about memory, about unconsciousness, about illness, about crisis, and about lots of other things that we'll show you on the last slide. If you want to know more about any of the approaches that you've seen on previous slides, Christmas is drawing near. We are not in the position to give you any present, but let me draw your attention to a handbook called Literaturwissenschaftliche Theorien, Modelle und Methoden einer Einführung. If you want to get this with a 35% discount, all you need to do is put down your name here, look at the table of content first, look at a couple of the reviews, because I edited the book. I'm not supposed to say any positive things about it. If you're interested in use historicism and in 12 other approaches that were already covered in this series, this is the place to get the book. And now it's Michael's turn. Thank you very much for your attention.